Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors.
You know something, Jim? I had a fantasy once that you and I would one day see a movie that was so shockingly poor and so scatterbrained and so monumentally, just monolithically stupid that we would be able to talk about it forever and the podcast would never end. I thought it's a pipe dream. You know, you got to let it go. It'll never happen. Jeff Wadlow has heard my prayers.
That day has come.
My prayers have been answered. Fantasy Island is upon us.
Yes, the subject of today's podcast is Blumhouse's Fantasy Island, which, it's just staggeringly bad. There's no way to get around it. Obviously, we're going to go into more detail, but for those of you unfamiliar with the premise, who didn't watch TV in the 70s, I mean, we didn't, we were not alive. Fantasy Island was a TV show in the late 70s, early 80s, where people would come to this island run by Ricardo Montalban and his man Friday, more or less.
Is his diminutive sidekick, Tattoo.
Yeah, and make people's dreams come true. And it was just kind of a sitcom, more or less.
Yeah, like sort of a supernatural soapy melodrama, I think, also, but with comedic overtones. I think that...
And it was TV in the 70s. It's what you would expect that premise to give you in 70s television.
Yes, and while I was not alive in 1977, I have never felt more alive than I do in this very moment. And I just really want to sink my teeth into this thing.
Yeah, so Blumhouse thought it'd be a brilliant idea to take that and turn it into a horror movie. And that's what we have now. So I'm going to...
Let me off my leash.
Yeah, I'm going to let Matt off the leash. And
let this
take
dog
it away,
hunt.
Man.
All right. We open with a prologue as a screaming blonde woman running through a jungle, and she runs into some kind of office, a pavilion, and the phone rings. She's hiding under a desk. Phone rings. She answers it, says, "You've got to help me. I've been abducted. They brought me to some crazy island. I'm being attacked." And the voice of Michael Peña assures her that everything will be all right. He says her name. We get the obligatory, "How do you know my name?" moment. And whatever. Then she's set upon by armed guardsmen. And we get our title drop, Fantasy Island.
Very ostentatiously, I might add, Blumhouse's Fantasy Island.
Oh, yes. Yeah. They're really, really wearing that like a badge of pride. Dissolve to Sandy Beach. We see a woman, Julia, is that her name?
Yes.
Frolicking in the surf, sort of absentmindedly. A plane comes in, light aircraft. Our hapless victims disembark. I don't remember any of their names. Let's see. First one onto the pier starts with an M.
Melanie.
And she's followed by these two douche bros.
JD and Brax.
Yes. And
who are brothers, despite the fact that JD is a somewhat tall white dude and Brax is a short Asian guy. You know, they're stepbrothers, as we come to find out.
We also get a guy named Patrick and a woman named Gwen. And Julia greets them on the dock. "Welcome to Fantasy Island, blah, blah, blah." They all think that they're in for the time of their lives. They start getting settled. We see the first indication that this movie is not just going to be a completely rote, uninspiring affair. We see a wild-eyed Michael Rooker crouching in the bushes, peeping on them from afar with like kind of camo mud smeared on his face, Apocalypse Now style.
He looks like a deranged Vietnam veteran who has been placed back in the jungle.
Our merry band are all bantering, really, really awful, stodgy, phoned-in banter for the most part.
Yep.
Melanie is coming on to Patrick very aggressively. And then Mr. Rourke arrives on the scene. He is the host, the proprietor of this amusement park, whatever it is, says that all their dreams are going to come true. But first, they're going to have a good night's sleep. And then their fantasies begin in the morning. And then almost immediately, right on the heels of that, the two bros, in every sense, are like, "Well, we haven't been given any accommodations. What's the deal?" And he said, "Ah, that's because your fantasy begins now." It's like, all right, that's you duplicitous snake. It's like, so you've said all of two words to these people and they were incompatible. It's like, are they getting a good night's sleep or aren't they? So, but these two guys wanted like a Scarface gang lord millionaire fantasy. And so Michael Peña leads them through the jungle and he just says something like, the party awaits, and they round a corner. And it's just like the quietest party in history. As like they emerge from the other side of a tree and you see dozens of revelers. The fucking looks like the Green Goblin is in the mix. They've got like a guy on like a water jet ski, like flying over the, I'd never seen that weird apparatus before.
Oh yeah, it's a thing.
There's fireworks going off. It's
so it's not the quietest party imaginable in the sense of nothing is happening. It's quietest in that they didn't hear anything until they rounded the corner.
Right. Which, you know, I mean, there's supernatural goings on Fantasy Island, so I guess that's not beyond the pale. But it sort of speaks to okay. This movie is chronically silly in ways both deliberate and very much accidental. And I think that was kind of an early red flag for me.
Yeah. So they plunge ahead with their party. JD's hanging out with models. Brax is also hanging out with models, but of the male variety, because it's kind of shoehorned in. But you guys ought to know, I'm gay. Okay. I mean, you could have just had him see some dudes and walk over to the dudes, but this movie's like, no, no, we're hip. We have a gay character, we promise.
They have a whole scene later devoted to like the two bros talking about how their parents disowned Brax because they're not hip to the, well, yeah, whatever. I'm completely coming apart at the seams here. No, yeah, the movie does kind of flaunt that in a way that feels very behind the times.
Very, very tacky.
Like it wants a, you know,
a pat on the back and a cookie.
Paper plate award, yeah, for for representation. Gwen, was that her name?
Yes.
Oh no, my fantasy is turning into a nightmare.
There's too much.
Stop the ride, I want to get off. Gwen, following morning, is talking to Mr. Rourke, Michael Peña, and he is telling her about how, oh, you know, most of the applications I see are pretty by the numbers, you know, a lot of sex stuff, but you have a kind of intriguing fantasy. It's a challenge, I accept. She wants a do-over. She wants to say yes to a marriage proposal that she had turned down 5 years prior. And he makes that happen. He says, you know, behind that door, your fantasy is waiting for you. She goes through the door and she is in a restaurant, upscale eatery, sits down, sees her ex. Obviously, she says, oh, they flew you in. I hope you didn't have to pay for it. Drop the act. What are you doing here? And he is none the wiser. He is acting like all of this is for real.
And she keeps harping on this point endlessly. Like, she keeps trying to get him to confess, and it takes her a long time to figure out, like, wait, this is real? I don't know. It's just one of the many tedious things in this movie.
I mean, to be fair, like, if I was confronting with something impossible, I would probably be even slower on the uptake and even more incredulous. But
then again,
this is a movie and you do have to get with the program at some point.
That's what I'm saying. Yes. Like, realistic, yes, but not fun to watch.
Meanwhile, we have Melanie and Patrick. Fucking A. We have Melanie and Patrick bonding again. They did not shack up that night, apparently. And he's wearing dog tags, and she asks him about it. He says, oh yeah, my fantasy was, and I always wanted to enlist, but I never did. Drops his whole backstory on her.
There's a lot of, like, incredibly inelegant exposition dumps. It's like this movie's only method of delivering exposition is via the dump.
Movie is a colossal steaming dump. He says, yeah, I wanted to be a soldier, but my mom vetoed it. I became a cop instead, but that didn't work out. There was an incident, and then I was got stapled to a desk. So I wanted to come here to play soldier.
I got stapled to a desk.
That's an expression, right?
I got stuck on a desk. I've never heard I got stapled to a desk.
Well, It would have been funnier if that was actually what had happened. He says, yeah, so I came here to play soldier, and I'm doing the grudge noise again. She's like, oh yeah, I want revenge on a childhood bully, someone who tormented me all through high school. And that's how we learn why they're there, just because they say it to each other in exhaustive detail. Which is, as Jim said, the only way that we learn anything about these people is by them saying it out loud.
Yep. It's as if some incredibly poor screenwriting teacher went to Jeff Wadlow, or whoever wrote this movie, I don't know if he did, I wasn't really paying attention to the credits, just went to them and said, the rule is, tell, don't show.
A lot of people have this backwards. Don't listen to them. Yeah, Jeff Wadlow's whole career can only be the result of some kind of monkey's paw situation. Like, there is Fantasy Island style, be careful what you wish for, magic afoot here, I think. It's the only explanation.
Jeff Wadlow is one of three credited writers on the film.
I see.
Along with Jillian Jacobs, but not the one from Community, spelled with a J, and somebody named Christopher Roach, who I know nothing about. So yeah, I blame Wadlow.
Michael Peña shows up to interrupt this stultifying conversation and says, come along with me, Melanie. Your fantasy begins now. He leads her to an elevator, says, take it all the way down. She obliges, steps off, and starts recording the whole thing for posterity. She's in a creepy bunker with a bunch of control panels, dimly lit. Hits a flashing button, lights snap on in some kind of sealed off glass tank where her childhood bully is strapped to a torture chair.
Incidentally, this is the woman from the prologue.
It is. We get confirmation of that fact in short order. Melanie starts messing around with a bunch of buttons and levers. She zaps her with a tiny little electric prod on her wrist, and she dumps toilet water on her head, which is one thing that apparently happened to her in high school. She got, like, carried at the prom, effectively.
Toilet water's a little bit lower key than blood.
Yeah, maybe so. Pick your poison, I guess. And then she posts a sex tape of the girl screwing around with someone who is not her husband to the girl's Facebook, thinking that this is all still some VR thing, that this is a hologram that she's looking at.
She keeps talking about Tupac.
She talks incessantly in this scene because she's recording the whole thing on her fucking iPhone. This is probably, we just said, characters just blather in this movie. The only way we learn anything is by them saying it out loud. This scene is the apotheosis of that. She gets down there and she's like, what is it? Is it like an envelope that says open me?
And she says, open me.
And she says, huh, open me.
You couldn't.
For the illiterates in the audience, I guess. And then when she looks at the sex tape, she goes, wait, that's not her husband. You know, it's there are more, whatever. Jeff Wadlow knows his audience, I guess. She then initiates a phone call between her bully, now turned victim, and her husband. He wants to know what's going on because this video was just posted to his fucking Facebook timeline or whatever. And she says, you know, you don't understand. I've been kidnapped. He says, is that George or Jeff or whatever in the video? You know, is that where you've been the past 2 days? Melanie goes, wait, 2 days? This is when she catches on awfully quickly that this is an actual person.
Yeah, I don't know why the 2 days line suddenly, like, why is that the trigger point?
Given revelations that later come to light, nothing could matter less.
Well, fuck. Yeah, I guess so.
But it is odd, and this whole scene is, it feels like a weird charade even the first time you're watching it, and that turns out to kind of be the case, but we're putting the cart before the horse here. She is trying to release, what is the bully's name?
Sloan
from captivity, and then a hulking torture doctor steps through a concealed door in the back of the chamber.
I'm sorry, I have to blow the surprise.
Yeah, speaking of putting the cart before the horse, I'm very sorry.
You called him a torture doctor because his name is Dr. Torture.
Torture. There's a wonderful, sublimely silly moment where Dr. Torture approaches the glass because Melanie is banging on it, saying, "Hey, stop, stop." And he pulls down his
surgical mask.
His surgical mask, revealing that his mouth, his lips have been sewn together like Hocus Pocus
style. Stapled, I think, actually.
Yes, he's like Patrick to his desk. And Melanie goes, "Dr. Torture."
So,
because this is like an avenging angel that she dreamed up when she was a bullied high school kid, I guess. Or,
No, you have it wrong.
Do I? Okay.
It makes much less sense.
Oh, good. This is the last time I'll try to foist sanity upon this shambles.
So apparently the bullying was so bad in, you know, middle school, high school, whenever this was supposed to have been, I think it was both, that Melanie had to undergo psychological counseling, and she nicknamed her psychologist, psychiatrist, whatever, her therapist, Dr. Torture.
What?
Yeah.
I have no memory of this. This came out during the Patrick conversation on, like, the veranda,
yes,
right? Okay.
During the rest of the second dump.
The steaming hot dump, right.
And I don't know why he was Dr. Oh, it was because he talked too much and she wanted to staple his lips shut.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
And he also made her write a bunch of, like, letters to the people she wanted to know better.
Right, and
like,
then the bully found them and distributed them all over school.
And
right.
Then she
that
became,
part I do
quote, psycho stalker girl. I think that was the sobriquet. It gets applied repeatedly. Anyway, so yes, she recognizes.
You remember when I said that the writer director of Countdown wouldn't know how to pronounce denouement? Sobriquet is too fancy for this movie. I think we're going to have to expunge those $2 words from our vocabulary for a little while.
You know, it's a little ironic. That was the idea.
Okay.
But anyway.
Pay me no mind.
Yeah. So.
Staple my lips shut.
Heaven forbid. So she recognizes her therapist. What confuses me is, I mean, psychiatry takes all kinds, I guess. There's theoretically no reason why a psychiatrist is required to be
taciturn.
Well, not that. I'm referring to, like, physical characteristics.
Oh, okay. Oh,
why a psychiatrist has to be like a sort of regular guy,
mountain
genial,
of man meat, right?
Yeah, as opposed to a mountain of man meat, which this guy's like 7 feet tall, mm-hmm, with biceps as big around as my head. I've got a big fucking head, so that's saying something.
Yeah, he's a brute. He's
an enormous brute, and apparently this looks exactly like her therapist, but she only figures that out once she sees his stapled mouth. I've said enough.
He's got a lot of other defining characteristics.
Let's
move
on
to get across. Yes, let's. So she gets the better of Dr. Torture. I will never tire of saying that out loud. My brain is being flooded with endorphins. It's like when a lab rat hits the button to get the cheese. I'm just going to say it over and over again. Dr. Torture, Dr. Torture. She gets the better of Dr. Torture by zapping him with the little prod and then dumping toilet water onto the chair, which only electrocutes him.
And not Sloan for not reasons quarry. That defy science.
And, well, you know, Fantasy Island, where the parties are only loud when you're looking at them. And electricity only works when it's convenient. So then the two of them book it out of there. Melanie claims that she was also abducted.
Yeah, there's
and the two of them are in this together.
There's a very dramatic shot of Melanie breaking the glass with a stool.
Oh, yes.
It almost looks like it was meant to be like a 3D shot with the stool coming toward the camera and out of the screen. It's awful. Anyway, please.
We catch up with Patrick now, who has been given he's out of his civvies, he's in his army uniform, and he's been dropped into the jungle, wandering around, armed, and then...
No, unarmed, actually. I don't think he has a gun.
That's possible. That does not seem very sporting,
no.
I have to say.
No, I'm pretty sure, because he gets dropped off by Rourke,
yes,
in a Land Rover. And Rourke just, like, hands him a rucksack with fatigues in it. I don't think he has a gun.
I think you're right. Michael Rooker ambushes him, leaps out of the grass, and puts a knife to his throat, says, "Shh, we're not safe here. People come here to die. I don't know. Maybe he says that later. You could almost, you could shuffle all of his lines like a deck of cards and it would basically not matter.
Yeah.
He's about to take a steaming hot dump, exposition dump, all over Patrick, tell him what's really afoot here. And then he sees soldiers coming out of the brush and goes, too many of them, and just bails. And so, then Patrick is apprehended by this squad.
Yeah, he tries to LARP his way out of it. And they're like, yeah, no, you're coming with us.
Yeah, you're not a soldier. You're American, but you know.
He gets transported. So even if he had to the LT.
Even if he had a gun, at this point, it would have been confiscated. So right. He now defenseless.
Because he probably wouldn't have shot them. So, yeah. He gets taken to the leader of the squad, the lieutenant. And to make a already very long story a little bit shorter, it's his dad. He's wearing his dad's dog tags. There's a whole thing about, like, my son is 9 years old, whatever. How can you be my son?
Yeah, because he's rifled through his wallet at this point, seeing that it's his son's name, that there's a picture of the two of them.
And they do the predictable enough back and forth, like, exchange of details.
Prove you're my son by telling the most maudlin story you remember. Okay, Pop.
And vice versa. Yeah. Like, it's so inane. But eventually they get on the same wavelength.
No, Pa, I didn't take the umbrella from Mom when it was raining because I didn't want you to see the tears on my face. It's like, good grief.
Works a lot better in a Temptations song.
Or a Lifetime movie. We get a couple fitfully amusing scenes here of the two bros, JD and starts with a B?
Brax.
Brax. You'd think I would remember a name like Brax.
Well, they comment on how unusual it is.
When they keep calling, he keeps calling him T. This is foreshadowing. This is planting and payoff going on here. He keeps calling him T.
Stop calling me. The nickname's terrible. I hate it.
I'm not playing. So like they're occasionally funny in like a douchey dude bro way. They're also fantastically annoying.
Yes.
In equal measure. JD especially. Is like very quippy and smarmy and is always assigning people nicknames that don't stick.
Yep.
And the two of them are living it up in this fucking Scarface mansion. There's an armory. There's a panic room. They're getting the lay of the land. They start playing around with a grenade that they find. They put it into like a baseball launcher.
A pitching machine.
And fire it out into the sea, or it hits the water and explodes.
And they high five for the 18,000th time.
And this is the single solitary edit in this movie that struck me as clever. We cut to the platoon with Patrick in tow, who hear a distant explosion and like get skittish.
Yeah.
So it's you cut from the Scarface fantasy to the war movie in a way where it actually feels like there's some kind of connective tissue there. There's some kind of thematic bridge. Most of the cross-cutting in this movie is very jarring. As people wade deeper into their discrete fantasies, it's like you're just jumping back and forth willy-nilly. And that was the one time where some care was put into how that jump was affected.
Yeah.
So we've already done things out of order, not that it matters.
Well, you know, we sort of mentally edited the movie to flow
into a more coherent shape, yeah.
So this, like, Russian gangster, played by a guy who I know for a fact is not Russian, shows up with his goons.
Yeah, his voice is like Rounders.
Yakov Smirnov.
It's Rounders. It's pure Rounders.
Give the man his fucking money.
Can you imagine? Because there's a big unmasking. When there's like a, like we're supposed to recognize him, like it's a twist or a reveal. If it had actually been John Malkovich, I would have
stood up and clapped,
shit my pants with glee. I would, you know, I would have just been beside myself.
Yeah. So basically this dude shows up and the male model that Brax fucked the night before, we're led to believe, gets shot in the head, and the group of them have to flee, and a bunch of the models get in the panic room and lock Brax and JD out, and they get captured by this pseudo-Russian gangster and his goons.
And at some point during this interlude, they paging Mr. Rourke. They try to, you know, call on him for help. Again, it's the stop the ride, I want to get off thing. And there's a kind of funny line. Well, there's two kind of funny lines. First, Brax, T, whoever, says, man, I'm not cut out for this. I don't even do escape rooms. And then Michael Peña issues his usual cryptic bullshit about how, you know, you have to follow the fantasy through to its logical conclusion. I warned you that that would be the case and that not all fantasies are what you expect. And T just goes, nobody knew what you meant by that.
Which is fair enough.
It's true, because everything he says is cryptic bullshit.
We cut to Melanie and
Sloan in the undergrowth, and Melanie is still keeping up her "we're in this together, we were both abducted" routine. This subplot is extremely tedious. You know, her trying to get away with this, pulling the wool over Sloan's eyes. Michael Rooker bamboozles them next.
Yeah, and at least up till near the end, and we'll get to that, but for most of this stretch, the only reason that Melanie feels the need to keep up a charade is to avoid an awkward conversation.
Right. In a life or death scenario.
Right. So anyway, yeah, Michael Rooker shows up.
There's another altercation with Dr. Torture, and they get the better of him. I think they kill him, actually. And then
I don't know.
Well, okay. So as they're walking away from his body,
right,
Black Ichor, another old chestnut of mine.
Yep.
I never tire of saying that out loud. Black Ichor, like, splorches out of his eye sockets.
And we've been seeing shit, like, dripping all around the fucking island and the hotel.
Yeah, it looks like blood or is dripping like a leaky faucet from a myriad of surfaces.
But yeah, no, as it turns out, it's our old friend Black Ichor just being everywhere. And we'll find out relatively soon what that is supposed to be.
We catch up with Gwen, who wakes up the morning after saying yes to her ex, now her husband, or a fiancé, she thinks. But in fact, her fantasy has caught up to the present day. She has been married to this man for 5 years.
They have a daughter.
Yes. Five-ish year old daughter. And she is still treating it like a VR thing, where she's like talking to Michael Peña on a bench about, you know, she sees the little girl and she's like, you can't do this. She's just a child. Like they've roped some child actress into this sham
or
production.
Kidnapped a child. Yeah, right.
It's not really clear what she means by that or what she thinks is going on, which is fair enough, I guess. But her incredulity is still kind of forcing this subplot to grind to a halt every time the movie jumps back into her fantasy. We now get another dump in the form of Michael Peña's backstory. As they're sitting there, he divulges his whole motivation for coming to the island in the first place and founding this supernatural resort getaway. Which is that his wife took ill and died, and he stays on Fantasy Island in order to prolong and perpetuate the fantasy of her still being alive.
Yeah.
He's got a wedding ring on his finger that has like a snake insignia on it, which we've seen throughout the movie.
Yeah, and we've never seen his wife.
Or have we?
Yeah, right.
Jim.
Yeah, I know. I was getting there.
I didn't think you'd forgotten. I'm just giving you a hard time.
I know. Fuckers.
Back to the platoon, the whole weepy umbrella monologue has persuaded Patrick's dad that his son is legit. Oh, and the other thing that comes to light here is that he died on this mission, Patrick's pa, saving his men, jumping on a grenade. And so then the two of them are going to go AWOL. That's the dad's idea,
yeah,
anyway.
Dad's like, fuck that.
So this fantasy is taking place in the early 90s. We learn this through maybe the clunkiest line. No, that's not even remotely true. The clunkiest line in the first or second act.
Right, exactly.
The third act is replete with just mind-bogglingly inept dialogue, and we'll get there when we get there. But we find out that we're in 1994 when one of the other soldiers quotes Dazed and Confused.
He doesn't even quote Dazed. Well, he does afterwards, but he says, like, you're looking pretty dazed and confused, you know, like that movie that came out last year. that's like,
all right,
that's like,
all right, all right.
Yeah, and then he says that. But, like, that's incompetent on the level of, do you know where my grandmother's a nurse?
Oh, yeah, that's one for the history books, too. So the two would-be deserters get into a tussle. Patrick can't deal with the idea of his dad not being a hero. So basically, he's telling his dad, no, you have to die, asshole. You will fall on that grenade. And they start wrestling in a river, and eventually Patrick gets the upper hand, says, if you desert those men, they're all going to die tomorrow in Venezuela on the mission. We have to save them, and we can keep you alive too, because I wasn't here the first time.
Now I am.
Yeah, now you've got backup. Michael Rooker is leading the two high school frenemies, arch enemies,
yeah,
through the jungle. Then they come upon a cave that looks like it's something out of Legends of the Hidden Temple, or like a rainforest cafe gift shop. It's like completely ersatz looking. And he tells them, "My name's Damon. I'm a PI." And that line also just like, I heard Ode to Joy and like levitated out of my seat a couple inches. It's like, I wish that the classic film noir like cello like beat had started playing under his monologue, because he starts talking about he's a private investigator who was hired to scope out this island and find out what was going on. So he,
you almost wanted like a black and white high contrast filter to just drop
some, like,
over
fucking,
the
like,
scene.
Frank Miller ass flashback to him in his office with the shades down. You know, a dizzy dame comes in smoking a cigarette and has a seat on his desk. This movie does end with a sequel hook, so maybe we can get a prequel too.
Oh,
fingers crossed.
Fuck.
And one more finger curls on the monkey's paw on Jeff Wadlow's desk. So Damon, I'm just going to keep calling him Michael Rooker. Damon is not a good detective name. It's like, it just doesn't fit the like hard boiled, whatever. He leads them through this cavern to this antechamber with a big spooky diamond rock thing. It's like the orb of Erised, basically. You look in it and it shows you your most fervent desire.
This is the reactor powering the island, essentially.
the battery. This is the beating heart of Fantasy Island. Sloane looks into it and sees her making amends with her husband. He says, I forgive you. Melanie looks in it and sees some hot nonsense that we're not meant to understand. And the filmmaking up to this point has been subcompetent, but that was still weird enough that it made me raise my eyebrow a little bit. I thought that like we were supposed to know what that vision meant, and the movie just hadn't adequately prepared for it somehow, or that like it was so odd that I didn't even know what was being conveyed. You know, it did not strike me as foreshadowing, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
It felt like some payoff where the planting had gone missing. I don't know. I just didn't know what to make of it, clearly.
Yeah.
And Michael Rooker takes a flask off his belt, and the orb of Erised is set into a little fountain that's just oozing with black ichor. And he puts some of it in his flask, tells them he wants to smuggle it off the island, because that's going to prove that Rourke is up to no good. I wasn't really sure how. The ichor makes your fantasies come true. You have to swill it in order to set things in motion. So I guess he spiked their drinks or something.
But it also turns people into zombies.
When it fucking feels like it. This is the scene where the liar is revealed, and Melanie, this tedious subplot to do with her duping Sloane, is finally quashed. Michael Rooker refers to Melanie as a guest, and then the two of them have it out, kind of, but they like bury the hatchet so quickly that I don't even know why.
Did we have this whole time?
Right, exactly. It's such a non-issue that, and like that could have been funny if it was played for laughs, but it's not. It like looks like it's going to be a thing, and then it just isn't a thing. Like so much in this movie. Here's where shit well and truly goes off the rails. So Gwen goes to, I think, Rourke first, and then to Julia, his assistant. And Julia is hacking up blood. We've seen her. She had a nosebleed earlier, but she is like damn near vomiting blood into a handkerchief. It looks like a bunch of spilled ketchup. You know, like they really. She looks like she's about to keel over. Maybe there was a shot I missed where she stashed it before Gwen saw it, but I think that she's just like holding it for most of their conversation, and Gwen does not appear to. Apparently, it's not cause for comment that Julia has minutes to live. So the reason that Gwen sought this audience with Rourke and then subsequently takes it up with Julia, she wants a different do-over. She insists it's not a second fantasy because everybody only gets one. One of the rules, apparently.
Well, no. Julia has to do that mental math for her. So Gwen wants just a new fantasy, new do-over where, because she said, when I met whatever her fucking husband's name is, you know, I was in a dark place and I didn't think I deserved love and that's why I turned him down, blah, blah, blah. Apparently, a year prior to their, it must have been like immediately prior to their meeting and a year prior to the proposal.
These are questions that the prequel is bound to answer,
right?
If and when we get it, fingers crossed.
At some point, there was a fire in Gwen's apartment building, and somebody burned to death, and it's her fault, and so she wants a do-over on that
because she can't enjoy this marital bliss with that on her conscience, knowing the island has the power to. Do the do-over that she actually wants, right?
So first, Julia doesn't want to help her because she doesn't think Rourke will let her or whatever. And then,
she's also probably woozy from the blood loss,
right?
Because holy shit!
I think you're overselling it a little.
I don't think I am.
It's not worth debating, but I think it might be a little less than that. Anyway, Julia does the mental math and figures out, wait, your fantasy was to rectify the thing you regret the most. And since that's actually the thing you regret the most, you haven't had your real fantasy yet. It's the same fantasy.
Yeah, and we're going to do it properly now. So she goes through the same door that had previously led to the restaurant where her fella popped the question. It now leads to a burning apartment complex.
Yeah, so she tries to put out the fire in her apartment. She can't. That's when we find out that it's actually her upstairs neighbor who burned to death or whatever. And she runs upstairs to try and help him.
And who should she see in the stairwell?
But JD and Brax.
Our two favorite douche bros.
She sees them from far away down like several flights of stairs and calls out to them. And they're just like, you gotta get out of the building, lady. It's on fire. They don't know who she is because it's past them or whatever.
At least they don't drop a reference to, like, a movie that came out that year to let us know where we are.
Well,
you know?
That's because
I'm completely fucking adrift unless you spoon-feed that shit to me, you know? Wait, where are we in relation to Dazed and Confused? That's the only way I can reckon time.
So
I would have grabbed them by the collar and been like, how long ago did Dazed and Confused come out? Sorry, I'm...
So this is when my heart just fucking sank.
Yeah.
I looked to Matt and I said, oh no.
Yeah, I can vouch for this. He, from here on out, my lovable co-host never stopped groaning and fidgeting, and it looked completely involuntary. Like you were less comfortable than Sloan was strapped into the fucking chair.
Covered in toilet water and being electrocuted.
So, long story short, too late. I told you this was going to be a never-ending episode. My fantasy is still curdling into a nightmare before my very eyes. Wait, no, I didn't want this. Stop the ride. She runs into damn near everybody from the island, all of her fellow vacationers. We find out that this is the incident that got Patrick stapled to a desk. Because he was outside and he waited for the fire department rather than going in and rescuing the guy. So it's on his conscience too.
Not super unreasonable, really, but fair enough.
Because it's not his beat. I mean, I think he's actually following protocol there from what I understand.
Well, yeah, I think the cops will typically be like, we have to wait for the fire department. But whatever.
So she fails to solicit his help and then runs back inside. Goes upstairs. Does she run into anybody else that we know? I don't think so. And then she collapses from smoke inhalation while trying to break down the door to her upstairs neighbor's apartment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh boy. We said earlier that the shot of Melanie smashing through the glass pane was pretty silly looking. The single silliest shot in the movie is coming up, and it's exponentially sillier than the
it's so bad.
Than the glass smashing. We get our unfortunately final scene with Detective Damon, who is still leading Melanie and Sloan. They've made it out of the jungle. They're on like a look more of a canyon environment, looks like. They're on a cliffside, and Dr. Torture, the fucking Energizer Bunny, just keeps on coming and attacks them, and Damon tackles him into the canyon to save Melanie and Sloan. And there's this shot of the two of them just plunging like stones through the sky from way far off. And I think it's so quick that I can't be sure, but I think it does that thing that I absolutely can't stand where the camera like zooms in and rack focuses on like airborne objects. That it's old
JJ trick,
pet peeve of mine. Yeah, JJ Abrams does it a lot. There was a lot of it in Man of Steel. You know, Zack Snyder does it occasionally. So you just see this like almost looks like live leak footage or something of these two dudes falling to their deaths, and it's really bizarre
and also just really lousy CGI.
Yes, and so then Melanie and Sloan continue on their way. We then get reality is just disintegrating at this point. The fantasies start colliding. It starts with the gangster millionaire fantasy intercepts the Venezuelan SEAL team fantasy.
Yeah, it turns out that their mission ends up being to rescue JD and Brax.
Right. So all of this, it started to remind me of the end of Blazing Saddles, where the cowboys bust out of the Western and start wreaking havoc in other movie genres. And if this had been a farce, it might have been really funny to see like this would-be Oliver Stone war movie suddenly like trip over its shoelaces and stumble into like a Narcos episode. But the tone is just...
It doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Beggars belief. So there's a lot of hullabaloo over JD and Brax are being tortured for information. They trick the gangsters into following them downstairs to the armory. Brax grabs a grenade. He's doing the whole, I've pulled the pin, I'm going to let go. And
I'm
so
crazy.
Yeah, then we get a hostage crisis. And the soldiers arrive on the scene. Patrick sees the grenade in Brax's hand, deduces that's the grenade that his dad is going to die taking a belly flop on. And it's just a whole fucking kerfuffle. The only thing that's worth recounting is that at one point, I believe Brax and John Malkovich are wrestling for the grenade. And Brax bites his hand and he makes this noise. sounds like he stepped on a Lego brick. I can't do justice to it, but you know, all of the gangster ne'er-do-wells get capped, and Brax retrieves the grenade, puts the pin back in it, but pockets it, I guess. So, crisis averted.
I'm sorry, I'm still laughing about the noise. Okay. Okay, get my shit together.
I want just like a one-button soundboard where I can just play that noise to my heart's content.
Yeah, like the Inception button. But for this guy.
But crisis not averted in point of fact, because then their eyes all splorch out of their sockets. You know, you get the black goop dribbling down their cheeks, and they all resurrect. And JD gets shot and killed. Patrick's dad gets shot and killed. I think all the soldiers eat it at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick's dad is the last one to go, and he's like trying to get Patrick out of there. And then and it turns into fucking Platoon.
I know.
For a
minute. Would be Oliver Stone thing. And it's so, again, the tone is fucking all over the place. Brax and Patrick flee into the jungle. Before he died, Michael Rooker told Melanie and Sloan that he knew a pilot who was going to get them off the island. They go back to the control room with the torture chamber in it and use the button to call Sloan's husband, because that has a designated button on this torture panel.
Yep.
And so his phone rings and he answers, and Sloan apologizes to him for her infidelity.
But it's also an apology to Melanie at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry for what I did to you. It gets maudlin. Yes. They get the husband to call the pilot to send in the plane.
So, I don't know. There might be more stuff prior to this, but basically what happens is the surviving guests all link up and they get out to the beach and they see the plane, and Michael Peña's like, it's all right. We want them to all be together. And then the plane is coming in for a landing. It just gets hit with a fucking RPG.
Yeah, it just takes a bazooka to the face and blows up. It's the silliest, you know, and this is like comedy film grammar. You know, you get like the object, boom, just comes in from the right and explosively dashes their hopes all over the water. It's like, that might actually be funny on purpose, but at this point, this movie was all out of, I'd completely run out of good faith. This movie had depleted my good faith stores.
I knew the plane wasn't going to land, but I honestly, like, a fucking, like, sea monster could have shot out of the water and just swallowed it whole.
Yeah, just a big tentacle drags it down into the briny deep. That would have been pretty great.
That would have been no more silly than
I would have
what happened.
Loved that reveal, actually, if all of this is happening because of the whims of some Lovecraftian entity that is like policing the beaches and making sure that they can't leave. I mean, that movie jumps the shark in all kinds of ways that wouldn't have been an order of magnitude more absurd than what's actually about to transpire. I thought what was going to happen is that it was going to be a North by Northwest ripoff where the plane just wasn't going to stop. I was going to try to mow them down.
That occurred to me also.
So I thought, like, all right, I've got your number, movie. This is what's going to happen. So then when the RPG hit it, it was even more ludicrous to my eyes.
It's the zombie gangsters that do it.
Yes.
Specifically, not John Malkovich.
Again, it's more Blazing Saddles nonsense. It's like they won't stay put. The fantasies are bleeding into one another. I mean, they've well and truly just turned into a one singular jumble at this point. I have a name written down in my notes. I want you to tell me how this name emerges from these characters' lips, because I don't remember.
Okay.
The name is Nick Taylor.
Okay. So, this is when we get the biggest, steamiest, smelliest dump of the whole movie. And
they start putting these pieces together before the plane blows up, I think.
No. I don't think so. Okay. I'm pretty sure all of this comes together all at once and is completely unprepared for, which makes it all the more offensive to the viewer. So, Nick Taylor is apparently the name of Gwen's upstairs neighbor who burned to death. And
they all have a connection to Nick Taylor insofar as, obviously, Gwen burned him to death.
Right.
Inadvertently.
She left like a kettle on or something.
Yeah. And then Patrick didn't go in and save him. And JD and Brax didn't go to rescue him because they thought he was out with some girl. Turns out the girl that they thought he was out with is Melanie, who says that she's to blame for his death because he shouldn't have been home that night because they were supposed to go out, but she got cold feet.
Right.
Her connection is the most tenuous because she wasn't even, everyone else was in the building.
Right. So then there's some really stupid fuckery. Like, they're trying to figure out who's doing this. Because
there's this fucking inane line that keeps coming up throughout the movie. I don't think this is my fantasy. I think this is someone else's fantasy.
Who gives a rat's ass?
It just happens over and over again. They keep having the same epiphany. And this is the moment where we get the big twist, we think, which is that this is the fantasy of someone who's avenging Nick Taylor. Who could it be?
Could it be Nick's mother? You know, Julia could be Nick's mother. They have the same eyes, kind of.
Yeah, Melanie trots that lame horse out. She said, "What? They have the same eyes. Julia could be Nick's mom." And it's so out of left field.
First of all, no. Julia looks like she's maybe 35. So fuck that. But ugh.
So now Julia's the big bad, apparently.
But they don't even... They don't even fucking stick to this for more than, like, 2 minutes.
No, they don't, because they go back into the Legends of the Hidden Temple cave, and they all get separated, and this reminded me of the second It movie in, like, the worst possible way, where they're all... You remember, like, Bill killing his brother with a cattle slayer, right? Did that happen? In a flooded basement?
Yep.
And
yep.
You and I, like, spent a couple minutes going, like, what... What? Why? What is that supposed to mean? Like, we get in an abstract way that he's coming to terms with his demons somehow, but the exact way that it plays out seems so arbitrary and bizarre. Like, we get that 5 discrete times in this fucking cave. They're all going spelunking and getting waylaid by different demons. Dr. Torture is there. Fucking, this is the silliest one. Sloan is confronted with a doppelganger who tells, I'm the real you, Sloan. OMG, you know.
She's just a bitch.
She actually says OMG.
And she does actually say OMG. This is also not the first time we've seen this doppelganger.
No.
And before it came back at this point, I thought there was going to be no payoff for that. Because the first time they're in the cave, you know, Melanie and Sloan are in there with Damon. We see the doppelganger for Sloan literally like skittering around on the roof of the cave, on the ceiling of the cave.
Mm-hmm.
But it does come back, and they, like, tussle. Why? What?
And Sloan feels like she ought not to even be part of the crew. I mean, having this baggage foisted on her, it's so incidental to the thing that's supposed to bind them all together, which is, like, Nick Taylor's death. And then, meanwhile, she's coming to terms with the fact that she used to be a bitch in high school. It's so low stakes. You get the stock possessed girl imagery with her scuttling along the cavernous roof.
There's a little bit more gibberish for a while, and then finally we get the big reveal that it was Melanie.
So Nick Taylor shows up looking all burnt.
This is not the first time he's appeared, by the way.
No, he's been
appearing and disappearing.
Peppered all throughout the movie, fleeting glimpses. And I didn't even get that it was supposed to be like a burnt cadaver. He just looks like Darth Maul.
Yes.
He looks like he's got like the red and black striping going on,
like,
on his face.
I didn't know if that was supposed to be the natives or a monster or whatever.
It did look like something out of Apocalypto.
Yeah.
Like I thought, yeah, oh, is this like an ancient Indian burial ground thing? That's kind of tacky. But especially since you're so proud of yourself for having a fucking gay character in 2020. But, you know, like, yeah, no. So we finally find out that's Nick Taylor. He confronts Melanie. That's what she's dealing with. But then we get her heel turn. And
which is just vomitous.
It's, yeah, complete bilge. It's, you know, it's my fantasy. You know, and as far as twists go, all right, so they all come to the island looking for a fantasy, right? And go fucking figure, the one who came to the island, the one who's... cover story was that she wanted a revenge fantasy is the one who was actually behind it all and who actually wanted a different revenge fantasy. It's like, Jesus Christ, it's not exactly Agatha Christie, is it? Like, I didn't expect any of them to be behind it, but gun to my head, yeah, obviously it's the one who already was kind of bloodthirsty, you know? Like, okay, all right.
And this raises all sorts of questions that we'll get to after the break. Because fuck me. But yeah, so she's talking about how she went out on a coffee date with Nick the day he died, and they were supposed to see each other again that night.
And she did not stand him up. She was waiting at the restaurant all night long and then found out that he died in a blaze.
And she was... There is... You know, for a movie that wants to pat itself on the back for being progressive and having a gay character amongst the main crew... This is the most regressive, crazy chick fucking archetype bullshit in the world.
The final twist hinges on the idea that the bully was right.
That this girl went out on one coffee date, fell madly in love with this dude.
And all of the psycho stalker slurs were 100% bang on accurate. They were psychological bullseyes.
We'll get to it more after the break, but God. The worst.
If anything, that Sloan didn't go far enough. She should have drowned her in toilet water to save them all from this nightmare. You know, Bill, bullies of the world, take note.
Right. Sometimes they are psychopaths. Your victims, that is.
Yes.
So, meanwhile, we also find out that Michael Peña is not the bad guy. And that was kind of a bummer just because it was a little bit fun to see Michael Peña play against type.
Yeah, I mean, his whole Bond bad guy. His whole Bond villain routine in this movie, you know, his like Ricardo Montalban impression effectively
right.
is good fun for a little while. But yeah, then he has his inexorable crisis of conscience where we get his wife, who is Julia.
Yeah,
forgot to mention.
Yeah, Julia is his wife, and every time she comes back to life, he just stopped telling her because it was too painful, and so she keeps dying.
Yeah, because his wish, for some reason, his fantasy is for the two of them to be together and for it to be the version of her, like
that when got sick and died.
That got sick and died. Yeah, because the way he phrases it, it's classic monkey's paw bullshit, evil genie bullshit, where he's like, "I wanted us to be together, just like we were before." Which means that she has to puke out all of her entrails and die over and over again in this Groundhog Day loop. And why is that his fantasy? Surely his fantasy is for her to be hale and healthy as a horse.
Yeah, for them to grow old and die together in 50 years.
So she dies in his arms, again, terribly maudlin, and he resolves to go back into the chamber of the Orb of Erised.
After he, like, gives in to his better impulses and his wedding ring evaporates upward. There's a lot of upward evaporation of the Black Ichor and the Black Ichor zombies. The same thing happens to his ring. And then there's his wife, who was also just dying, has disappeared. And there's just an incredibly wide shot of him standing there. And it looks like he's about to call out, like, "Hello?
Line?"
No, where'd everybody go?
He looks so disaffected and just kind of like in his own thoughts. It looks like he didn't know the cameras were rolling. Like it was B-roll or something. I don't know. It's not. Usually you cut to a wide in a scene like that to like emphasize his aloneness, but it just made him look kind of disoriented.
I think it was because it was too wide.
Maybe.
He looks stranded in this fucking cave.
So then we skipped over a crucial detail, which is that before he has this crisis of conscience, he kind of lackadaisically tosses the grenade, which is still in play, believe it or not, into the fountain before he goes out of the room in order to dispose of it, because their plan was to destroy the orb at this point.
Yeah.
And so why... in God's name, I don't care if it still has the pin in it. Why would you put the grenade under the orb? Even if you think that Melanie's about to win and they're all about to die, it's like, why would you, like, I get that it's a body of water, but anyway, you need to know that the grenade is in the fountain. That's all for what's about to go down. And what does go down? It's such a fucking muddle.
Michael Peña comes back and Melanie's still doing her, like, tedious
villain
routine.
Oh, I remember. Okay, go on. Yes,
yeah.
Sorry.
And basically, Michael Peña reveals, "Sloane, you were brought here as part of someone else's fantasy. You haven't had your own fantasy. If you drink the water," which she conveniently has slung over her shoulder, because Melanie put it down in the cave before we knew that she was the bad guy, for no reason. None. No reason whatsoever. Just as a plot device so that Sloane could get it.
Well, and it's weird, too, because Michael Rooker entrusts it to the pair of them. So he could have just as easily given it to Sloane in the first place.
Doesn't matter.
And then she would have just had it.
Sloane's got it now.
It's stupid that she can even get it to her lips because she's being physically restrained. They all are by the gangsters, the zombie gangsters with the black ichor leaking down their faces.
Yeah. And she drinks, and then her fantasy is for Melanie to be together with Nick forever. And so Nick, the burned corpse, literally springs out of the water.
Yeah, like Jason Voorhees style.
And drags her down into the pool underneath the orb. And then everybody's like, "Great,
where
yeah,
we presumably did it." Dies of a fatal fantasy overdose.
Yay, we did it, woo. And then she springs back up out of the water and hurls the grenade out. And this is when...
Holy shit.
Patrick gets his hero moment, and he falls on the grenade just like his dad did. And in 1994 in Venezuela, the year after Dazed and Confused came out.
And the grenade goes off, and we get this just blinding light. It's like he threw himself onto the Ark of the Covenant, and then the, you know, fade to white. Gwen wakes up back in her bungalow near the beach.
Yeah, and the survivors, basically just Sloane and Gwen and Brax. Not basically, it is just them.
Michael Pena walks in, no hard feelings, apparently. And
I'm going to stay here, protect the island, whatever, and they're going to get the plane out of here. And there's some hand-waving about how, like, fantasies are like dreams. You rarely remember exactly what happened. You just remember how it made you feel. It's like, it made them all feel terrible.
And it's a great line to go out on, because I will not remember the events of this movie, but I will remember the way it made me feel. I will take that to my grave.
So Gwen and Sloane get on the plane, and Brax is like, I don't know what to do now. My brother's dead.
It's the same thing that they just did with Sloane. Michael Pena's like, well, you know, technically you were here as part of your brother's fantasy. You haven't had your own yet.
So
much fucking fine print.
None of it makes sense. So he says, I want my brother back. I want him to live a long and happy life with his girlfriend that he broke up with, but is going to get back together with, because realize what she meant to him. So Michael Pena's like, okay, yeah, I mean, you can do that, but you have to stay on the island in order to perpetuate your fantasy for as long as possible. So you have to stay here forever, and you have to work for me. And it's like, okay, cool. And then the plane's flying away. Gwen and Sloane are like, wait, no, stop, pilot. We got one more passenger. And then fucking JD just pokes his head out from the cockpit and says, yeah, I don't think he's coming. Then waves goodbye to his brother, who's standing on the end of the dock
right,
with Michael Pena.
So Brax, I guess, is mentally projecting this weird revenant that you know, is just going to go about and exist in society. The implications are just mind scrambling.
The final note we go out on is Michael Pena tells him you need a uniform and a name tag. And I don't remember exactly what the line is that sets it up, but it's like, yeah, I've got this nickname.
I think he complains about the name Brax being kind of difficult for his customers to pronounce or something like that.
Which is weird, because it's very simple.
Yeah, it's monosyllabic.
Yeah,
you know?
And phonetic. But however it happens, this is when we see Brax's terrible tattoo, which is just a tattoo that says tattoo. That's how he got the nickname T.
And that's why he's so ashamed of it. It was like a college dare or something.
Yeah. And Michael Pena's like, ha ha, very well, tattoo.
Welcome to Fantasy Island. And then there's this shot that like zooms in on them. Like it's going to be a big sequel hook. And all the Fantasy Island fans in the audience who have been waiting for this movie since 1977 just collapse into puddles of joy, because they've been watching an origin story this whole time.
Cut to black. Movie's over. And so is this segment after nearly an hour and 20 minutes.
Hit me with a fucking RPG.
We'll be back after the break.
I'm curious how this all works.
What if your fantasy involves a person from your life?
Holograms. Like Tupac.
What if it's somebody who died?
Tupac.
So, what's your fantasy?
Revenge on a childhood bully.
Your life is about to change. I hope you're ready.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/Shock Doctors Pod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. Podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Oh my god, that's really her.
Rourke, this is not what I meant!
What the hell is this place?
People die here.
And we're back. So, I'm going to kick this segment off by...
Sorry, I don't know what came over me.
I'm going to kick off this segment by expressing my complete fucking bewilderment the character of Melanie, because Jesus fucking Christ.
Strap in, folks.
Her character does not make sense. The single biggest thing about her that does not make sense is why, in God's name, when she goes down to the fucking torture chamber control room, where she is entirely alone, except for us, and her camera recording, which she doesn't even, like, try to show to people later as some kind of...
Ah, but she does. See, she does show it to Sloane. It's one of the stupidest scenes in the movie. It's to prove that she rescued her. Remember, they have a whole, like, interlude in the jungle.
Sure, there's that, but... Like, she doesn't show it to the other people to try and be like, see, yeah, this is, I'm an okay person. I'm not laying in the weeds this whole time. So she just fucking acts for no one but us.
And says, like we complained about before the break, every thought that comes into her head, open me. That's not her husband. And, you know, that's just scratching the surface. Yeah, no, I mean, it is a total charade for whose benefit?
Ours.
Yeah,
that's
the audiences.
It. That's the thing that's so fucking offensive about it.
Well, and so,
there is no reason, no fucking reason at all for her character to be acting like she's not a sociopath, except for the fact that it would spoil the twist.
Well, and she does try to use that video she took to win Sloane's confidence. So in a nuts and bolts way, there's an explanation for why she might pretend to be like a babe in the woods and like, oh, it's a hologram. Oh, this is VR. She looks better than Tupac. But I'm not going to bat for it because that explanation is woefully inadequate. It can't dispel the stink of this subterfuge. Because it is strictly for the audience's benefit. And her descent into villainy is... dizzying. It's so, she doesn't have a character effectively. We know some things about Melanie, and then all those things go out the window, and this new person is drowned by Darth Maul.
She is not the subject of a twist. She just is a twist.
Uh-huh.
She's just a twist in human form. And why? Also,
why indeed?
Also, as we touched on prior to the break, her archetype is so offensive.
Sure.
It's like staggering. Like, if this were a movie of substance that people gave a shit about, this is the kind of thing that could set back the portrayal of women in film by decades.
And
fortunately,
look,
this is a worthless piece of fluff trash, and it doesn't matter. But good Christ, what is this, 1981? Like, we're allowed to put female characters in who are literally just insane, clingy fucking messes? Why?
Yeah, between
God,
this,
why?
Between this and the dits in the new Zombieland, we're really,
that,
you know.
That's, Zoe Deutsch's character in Zombieland 2 is like Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, no.
Compared to this.
No, by comparison, she deserves to replace Andrew Jackson on the bill. Yeah, no. She's a crusading champion of women's rights by comparison. It's really odious. Now, I'll say this. You can go back further than 81. Carrie, one of my favorite horror movies, also ends with a put-upon victim of bullying massacring a bunch of people who didn't really deserve it. It's a masterpiece. So, like, I don't have to get on a soapbox about these things. It all comes down to the execution. This movie has very little, almost nothing going for it, and then this twist hits you like an RPG out of fucking nowhere.
From right of frame.
And because the movie has done nothing to secure your investment and nothing to make you want to play devil's advocate for it, it's bad politics are just kind of hung out to dry, and your disdain becomes further cemented.
But
that was my feeling anyway.
Here's the thing. Carrie
is in a trance, first of all.
Well, okay. Carrie's in a trance. And you can talk at length. We're not going to, but you can talk at length about, yeah, okay, there's certain things about Carrie and the character of Carrie that are dated and kind of regressive. But the most regressive things about Melanie in this movie are not the features that are lifted from Carrie.
Yes.
If it were just...
It's closer to Fatal Attraction, like that kind of like stock crazy lady.
Yes. That's exactly right. I don't know why I didn't think of Fatal Attraction. But yeah, no, if it was just Melanie couldn't get over being tortured in middle and high school and she wanted to act out this vengeance on Sloane, and that was the whole movie, also there'd be a lot less going on in the movie. It would have been terrible for that reason. But at least that's not like incredibly regressive. It's the fact that...
No, that's what gets her to the island in the first place. That fantasy. You know,
right.
Revenge on the bully, and that's where it stops.
But the thing that makes her the crazy lady, capital C, capital L, fucking stock archetype that should have been retired forever ago, and I thought was, is that
she went on one date.
She went on one coffee date. not
crucial
even
distinction.
Dinner. Not even lunch. Not a movie. They went out for fucking coffee, and she was so in love with this guy. She talks about how when she didn't hear from him that night, she just was in despair. She just went down a rabbit hole of insecurity and self-doubt. And then also, once she found out that he died in a fire, she wanted everyone who is vaguely connected by proximity to that situation to die.
Yeah, she
to
goes.
Die
she
go, for it.
She goes
for this guy she talked to for an hour over coffee.
Yeah, for that she goes Kaiser Soze on everyone who had anything to do with it. Yeah, it's Drek. I mean, the last 20-ish minutes of this movie are a masterclass in incoherence. I mean, it's just the most inept flailing. I mean, there's a reason that I kicked off this episode the way I did. I mean, it really did feel like some kind of apotheosis was being reached. Like this is it. We can go no further. This is the dumbest thing. And the movie is not good, but it is not galactically bad until pretty close to the finish line, and the fact that it saves all of that for the finale is part of what sent me over the moon, because you've relaxed into it and you think you're just watching this ho-hum, nothing to write home about thing, and then all of a sudden, it would be like if I turned to Jim and suddenly realized he was just a bunch of Cocker Spaniels in a trench coat. Like, this whole time, we've been friends for years, and you know, and it's like that level of bleh. It's a sight to behold. And the thing is, there are things in this movie that I don't hate conceptually. A few of them you get very early on. I mean, the prologue is basically worthless with Sloane hiding under the desk.
It couldn't be more stock.
Yeah, right,
tried.
Exactly. Title drop, blah, blah, blah. And then this shot of Julia, right? In the waves. The shot of Julia, all of the cinematography in this opening scene is pure Firefest marketing. It looks like those promo videos that they put together to, you know, again, lure hapless millennials to this torture island. I kind of thought that this whole movie was going to be a riff on that kind of thing. You know, when they get off the plane, they all look like pretty Instagram influencer people. So I thought maybe there's something a little sneaky and satirical going on here. Well, not that sneaky. I thought it was pretty on the nose, actually. But then the movie bifurcates and trifurcates and goes down so many weird rabbit holes that it doesn't make any overarching point about anything other than maybe bully the weird kid harder because, you know, just to be safe. Yeah, right. So this scene looks incredibly sloppy. Just the scene of the river wrestling sequence with Patrick and his dad when they're bailing on the squad. They do like a series of cartwheels almost. It's some Cirque du Soleil shit. Like one flips the other. It's the like Pindia move from The Lion King. One like flips the other over and then the other flips him. And I think it happens a third time and they just keep like a tumbleweed just rolling down this river. It's ludicrous looking. And then, so that's awful. But then you get an echo of it in the cave at the end where the two of them are wrestling in another river. And I thought, oh, that's a callback. If this movie was doing anything else right, that would be kind of a cool moment in a, like a we've come full circle kind of way, but it's not. I had a similar reaction to Melanie's death, because she wears this necklace the whole movie, and we get during her big steaming villain monologue dump that it comes out that this necklace was it a gift?
No, she bought it special for the follow-up date.
Of course,
because
you don't buy someone a gift after one coffee date. She has been wearing it basically on Nick's behalf all these years. And when Nick drags her into the ooze fountain, he grabs the necklace and yanks her back. And again, I thought, that's kind of a nice touch. If this movie was doing anything else right, it might warrant some kudos. But I was so beaten down and bewildered by that point that nothing could have saved this movie. Not even the reveal of the tattoo, which is kind of funny. A tattoo that says tattoo in the typical, like, font, this awful piece of ink on his shoulder. It's a little bit funny in, like, a Hangover movie kind of way.
Yes.
Hangover sequel
kind of way. Exactly the
way
in which it is funny.
But it's too little too late.
Yeah, as Matt was saying, the fact that this movie is as terrible as it is does sneak up on you. I said this to Matt as we were walking out of the theater, and I stick to it. Fully halfway through this movie, I legitimately thought, I don't know if we can do a podcast on this.
Well, like Escape Room, it's basically not a horror movie. And that was what I thought my take on it was going to be at the midway point in the film, was that this is like, this really isn't what we do. We're going to do it anyway, just kind of begrudgingly, like we did an episode on Escape Room. But it's a bunch of set piece PG-13 pseudo action movie kind of stunt work. It's a horror movie only in the barest, most superficial sense.
Yeah.
So our take was exactly the same.
And also it was like, this is not good, but it's also not bad enough to really be worth comment. It's just kind of there. And then the dopey story stuff and silly shots start piling up and then kicks into overdrive there near the end. And just, wow. Again,
wow,
like I said, at the moment when Gwen spots JD and Brax going down the stairwell in her apartment building as she's going up, my heart sank. And I said, oh,
that
no.
was the moment. Well, this movie jumps multiple sharks on a jet ski, practically, or a water-powered Green Goblin suit, or whatever that
right.
thing is. And that was the first, as you said, oh no, moment, because you thought you were watching this escape room-esque characters in peril movie that's not really a horror movie, that's trying to do this weird charcuterie board of different genres. And it's nothing to, it's going to be in one ear and out the other. And then it turns into like a Paul Haggis movie all of a sudden. It turns into fucking Crash on you with the burning apartment and, oh, they all know each other. All their interlocking lives. Wow. It's so profound. If that was the only weird twist in this movie would have already lost me. I mean, that's the moment when it lost me. And then it kept losing me again and again. I felt like Julia coming back from the dead only to vomit up kilos of blood. And then it just kept sinking below my already subterranean expectations. And that burning apartment house scene was really the first kiss of death. And the rest of the movie was just a parade of kisses of death.
Yeah. I'm going to go on a brief screed against the director, Jeff Wadlow.
Give it to him.
Yeah. Who, first of all, I have seen all but one of his films, which is tragic in and of itself.
Let me guess, the Kevin James Netflix one you have not seen?
I have not seen.
Okay.
Yeah, so his first film was Cry Wolf in 2005. It is a bog-standard, fairly terrible boarding school slasher movie. It's not good.
It's an okay title.
It's an okay title, and in general,
I haven't
whatever.
Seen it, in case that wasn't apparent.
it's not good. Then he did Never Back Down, which is about this dude getting into an underground fight club at his high school. And that's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And then he directed Kick-Ass 2, which Quentin Tarantino liked for some reason, but no one else did because it's not great. And this is something I'm saying as a fan of the original Kick-Ass. The sequel is not very good. Then he did True Memoirs of an International Assassin, which is a Kevin James Netflix movie. Nothing else need be said. And then his last film was another Blumhouse project, also starring Melanie, Lucy Hale, by the name of Blumhouse's Truth or Dare.
That's the only one of his that I've seen other than Fantasy Island, and I have my co-host to thank for both of them.
Yes, and we saw Truth or Dare shortly before we started doing this podcast, because otherwise it would have been...
Prime fodder.
Prime fodder. That movie is also terrible. In like a almost a Slenderman level friend request adjacent kind of terrible.
Yeah, it is in good company. It belongs to that tier.
And then he made Fantasy Island. This man puts out nothing but schlock. Not even fun schlock. Just schlock. Why do people keep giving him money? I am offended. I am deeply offended by the fact that this man gets paid to do what he does.
Fantasy Island has grossed $33 million worldwide against its $7 million budget, which is why people keep giving him money, because he keeps making money.
Directors on movies like this are fucking interchangeable.
Yeah.
They're spare parts, basically. Anybody... I can't say this from the perspective of someone who has gone out and directed a $7 million horror movie and gotten it to gross money. So caveats abound.
Yeah, our usual armchair critic routine.
But nevertheless, out of the roster of professional directors, I guess I'll put that on it to make myself sound like less of an asshole. Out of the roster of professional directors.
And you do almost want to put professional in scare quotes, you know.
You could put anybody in charge of a PG-13 horror movie that Blumhouse pumps out for $3 to $5 to $7 million, and it would make money because Blumhouse knows how to market a horror movie. And this is why horror movies, even the bad ones, keep getting made, because they don't need to be good to be successful. They don't even need to make a ton of money to be successful. If you make $50 million on a $7 million budget and you don't spend a lot of money on marketing, you'll do that every day and twice on Sundays. This is why Blumhouse is huge. And then on top of that, they have a few movies that actually do ridiculously good business or are actually very good, you know, like Get Out, for example.
Yeah, which is bound to happen eventually, just statistically. Yeah. Jason Blum is eventually going to crank out.
It's almost inevitable.
Yeah.
So on that basis, why the fuck can't they let... Why the fuck can't they pay somebody else $300,000 or whatever the fuck he got paid? Some enormous pile of money by our standards and even by film person standards. Fuck it. $300,000 is nice. Why can't they throw that money at somebody else who might be at least a little bit less fucking incompetent? He's had 6 tries.
QT likes him.
Fuck
that. He's got his finger on the pulse of the horror community.
Jeff Wadlow had to have sent Quentin Tarantino a bunch of pictures of feet. That's the only explanation I have for
yeah,
that.
He's got something on him. There's some kind of
also
conspiracy.
Quentin Tarantino sometimes has bad ideas about what movies are good. So I'm just going to put it down to that.
But I think that Quentin Tarantino is born and bred in a grindhouse and has a fairly high tolerance for... I don't know. He said of Kick-Ass 2, what was it, that Wadlow has an auteur sensibility.
Yeah.
Or something like that. I don't disagree with that assessment. I do think Tommy Wiseau is an auteur. He makes movies that only he could make. He is the author of the film. Jeff Wadlow meets that. His filmography cannot happen by mistake. It is a grand design. You don't make the movies he's made back to back to back to back. There's a zeal there. There's a passion and a weird kind of integrity almost. That he's that committed to his own suckitude.
It boggles the mind.
But having only seen Truth or Dare, this, I mean, Fantasy Island is sub Truth or Dare for me. I mean, I think Truth or Dare was the kind of ho-hum, nothing to write home about, nothing to see here, move along, folks, kind of movie that I was afraid Fantasy Island was going to be. And then Fantasy Island became something else.
Yeah.
I think on the face of it, the idea of doing a slasher movie rendition of a half-remembered TV show from the late 70s is kind of funny. I expected this to just be like an I Still Know What You Did Last Summer kind of thing, where it's just pretty people being killed on an island.
Yeah.
And that's it. Does what it says on the tin. I did not expect it to go all in on the Indiana Jones bullshit. With the orb and the relics and the magic and the zombies and all of the other impossible shit that hits the fan at myriad points throughout the film. you get the sense that this material could have worked if it had been... The first time I saw a trailer or a poster or whatever for this movie, my thought was like, this can only work if you take it in like a 21 Jump Street reboot kind of direction.
Yeah.
Where you make fun of the fact that no one really was that fond of this show to begin with, and there's no point in rebooting it, and it's cynical, and nobody asked for this. And there's a little bit of 21 Jump Street energy to some of the Scarface stuff.
Yeah.
And like, it flirts with it, but it never turns into an out-and-out comedy. And I wish it had, because it's never scary. And I mean, I likened it to Blazing Saddles for a reason when all of the streams start getting crossed. You know, that's, it's a recipe for comedy, for farce. I mean, for fourth wall breaking, genre defying farce. And it's just so committed to this. The word we kept using before the break was maudlin. It keeps trying to turn into a tearjerker on you. And I get that maybe that's true to the spirit of the show, if it is this soapy supernatural melodrama. But good God. I mean, the first one caught me by surprise, which was Patrick and his dad talking about the fucking umbrella. You know, I'm like, why is this getting so schmaltzy on me? It felt like a weird outlier. And then scenes like that just kept recurring. You get Michael Peña and his bride dying in his arms. You get
Sloan apologizing to her husband, and also Melanie.
Yeah. JD has an ex that he's not over that we don't even get into. There's this sappy thing that he kept saying that he keeps saying about how she's his
moon and stars.
Moon and stars. Yeah. It's
this movie tries at different points to be a horror movie, kind of a comedy and a melodrama, and it fails on all counts.
Yes.
Gloriously fails. It doesn't work on any front.
And like, the comedy usually isn't funny either. There's one or two lines that made me titter. I think the reason I'm insisting that this might have worked as a comedy is that bad horror defaults to being funny.
Yeah.
And so if you know that you've made a kind of middling horror movie, throw in some more jokes. It doesn't have to have a satirical agenda. I mean, I brought up the Firefest stuff because it seemed like maybe that could have been another direction to take this. One sure sign of a movie that's completely failed is when I'm trying to talk about its failure and I keep volunteering different fixed things that might have saved it, like complete overhauls, not just little tweaks here and there.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it could have been a Firefest thing. Oh, it could have been a 21 Jump Street thing. It could have been this. It could have been that. It's not any of those things.
No.
It's irredeemably bad. And if the maudlin stuff is for Fantasy Island purists, like, what? Fan service needs fans. I don't know who was clamoring for this, which is why I said you do the 21 Jump Street thing. You make fun of the fact that nobody asked for it. But this movie is just so misbegotten on a foundational level, right up to the whack-ass conclusion. Hello, Tattoo! You know, I'm sure that his name was not spelled Tattoo in the original. It was probably like T-A-T-U or like Audrey Tattoo or something. Something a little more exotic. I don't know. That's like, if people cared about this property, this intellectual property, that would be the new, like, who are your people? Han Solo, like moment that everyone was decrying on social media. Is it such a stupid backronym? But no one cares. Nobody cares. I don't even care.
Apparently, Tattoo in the original Fantasy Island was T-A-T-T-O-O, so.
Really?
Yes.
His name was Tattoo.
Yes.
All right.
And he was played by, what's his name, from Man with the Golden Gun.
What do you know?
So.
It's not too late for us to just scrap this episode and talk about Roger Moore era James Bond, if you think that would be more edifying. Because holy shit.
No.
What,
no, thank you.
What a mess. What a mess I've made. Are you happy, Jeff Wadlow, that you've turned my beautiful dream into this sick shambles?
Well, you know. Fantasies rarely turn out the way you planned them.
You have to see it through to its logical conclusion.
You just turned into Bela Lugosi.
If Bela Lugosi had walked into the chamber of the Orb of Erised and said, no, it was me all along, that would have been a welcome reprieve.
I never drink wine.
I never drink, I don't know, whatever you call it.
It's black water.
Yeah, right. There's a line that Michael Peña has when he interrupts Melanie and Patrick on the veranda when they're dumping on each other. He overhears her say something to the effect of, isn't that why people go to horror movies and roller coasters? To be transported, to be thrilled? Because he's talking about how his fantasy is stupid because he's fantasizing about doing something kind of arduous, and because he's not going to be like boozing it up with supermodels. So he thinks that that's not a legitimate fantasy. And she's like, well, you know, people go to horror movies to be scared. People go on roller coasters to be scared. And Michael Peña.
Yeah, Jeff Wadlow. I go to horror movies to be scared. You fucking dick.
Or just to be entertained in one form or another. And then Michael Peña comes up to them and says, oh, I think you'll find that Fantasy Island is more thrilling than... Now I don't even know what voice I'm doing. I think you'll find that Fantasy Island is better than any roller coaster. Would that it were. Would that it were, Jeff Wadlow.
And I don't even fucking like roller coasters. And yet I agree. Well... After nearly 2 hours of recording, I think we can bring this bitter ray of sunshine to an end. This has been another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisi. And this movie effectively has no protagonist. This is my last point. This is such a fatal structural flaw. I think it accounts for what a weird, I'm going to use my co-host's phrase, not that he coined it, but dog's breakfast. What turns this whole thing into such a dog's breakfast is that you don't... Melanie is the first one to get off the plane, so you kind of think, okay, here's our point of view character, but then Gwen is the one who initiates the revelation of all the Paul Haggis nonsense about the burning apartment building, and then Patrick is the one who gets the hero's sacrifice at the end. So it's all of their stories, it's none of their stories. I mean, Melanie's the villain, so obviously she's not the protagonist, but it's just, it's movies don't need protagonists, they don't need to fit a tidy three-act structure, they don't need to play by the rules. But this movie
could have used some rules and not just broken ass
Fantasy
Blackwater
Island
rules.
Yeah, right. Fantasy Island fine print. Okay. He's Jim Smith. I'm Matt Gerandaisi. We're the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Fantasy Island Official Trailer HD, uploaded by Sony Pictures Entertainment. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, March 8th, and we'll be discussing The Lodge, Severin Fiala and Veronica Franz's follow-up to Good Night, Mommy. See you then.